Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hey everyone, Renee Powers here. This episode is for the true word nerds. I'm excited to share this conversation about feminist sociolinguistics with Amanda Montell, the author of the book Word Slut. And that might sound like a super boring topic, but I assure you, Amanda brings a ton of levity, humor, and just fascinating topics to the table. But just a note, because we are discussing language and cover the history of many gendered curse words, we'll say, we're really leaning into that explicit rating today. So if you are listening around younger ears, you may consider headphones. Just a couple of super quick announcements before we dive in. We will be featuring some of Amanda's videos over on the Feminist Book Club blog over the next few months. You can find that at feministbookclub.com/blog. And if you haven't checked out our blog yet, that's where the show notes to these episodes are housed, plus our Educate and Activate series, where our blog contributors define, contextualize, and provide resources for some common social justice terms you may have been hearing lately, and just a host of other fantastic content. So make sure that you are heading over to feministbookclub.com/blog and checking out what we have to say there. Our next announcement is that our July box has sold out, but you can still join at the book-only level, and that's $20 a month. We will send you a book of the month, and July is With the Fire on High by Elizabeth Acevedo. And then you will have early access to actually upgrade your membership to the box level the first week of July. Because we are still playing catch up with some of the demand we've experienced recently. Thank you. We've only actually been able to add 50 box subscriptions for August, and I do anticipate that they will sell out, and I am so sorry for that. I promise I'm not trying to drum up some like gross false scarcity as a marketing ploy. That is not my game. I'm working really hard to have more than enough boxes available in the fall, but just a warning, if you want to have an early opportunity to get the August box, be sure you've signed up at the book-only level for July. Those book-only level subscriptions never sell out. So if you just want the book for $20 a month, you are always welcome to join us. There is no fear of that selling out. The boxes, which include 3 to 5 products from woman and queer-owned businesses, those do sell out. The issue is the product, not the books. So make sure that if you want the boxes, you sign up now at the book-only level, and then you will receive early access to upgrade that before that goes out to the general public, if that goes out to the general public. I kind of think it won't. So that's the quick and dirty of what's going on with the Feminist Book Club subscriptions. So now put on your nerd hats, because this conversation dives super deep into geek territory, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Here you go. Hi, everyone. Today, I'm chatting with Amanda Montell. Amanda is a writer, linguist, and author of the critically acclaimed book, Word Slut, A Feminist Guide to Taking Back the English Language, published by HarperCollins in 2019 and is now available in paperback. Word Slut has been praised by Time Magazine, Harper's Bazaar, Kirkus Reviews, Publishers Weekly, and the New York Times. Amanda lives in Los Angeles, where she's currently developing Word Slut for television with FX. While working on her second book, which is about the language of cults, in her spare time, Amanda enjoys learning practical languages, doting on her spoiled pets, and volunteering as a crisis counselor for LGBTQ youth. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me. Wow, I've never heard that version of my bio read aloud before, and I was like, ooh! That sounds good.
It sounds like we need to be best friends, actually.
I'm down. So,
all right, before we jump into why we should be best friends, the first question I ask everyone is, what is your definition of feminism?
You know, it's so funny because I wrote this book called Word Slut, A Feminist Guide to Taking Back the English Language, and people almost never ask me to define what feminism means for me. And I think it really is one of those words that's that's super individual from person to person, because it's this all-encompassing movement that evolves so quickly and there are all these waves. And I think it can be kind of overwhelming. I think for me, you know, feminism is all about working toward achieving gender equality from an intersectional standpoint. So really thinking about all the different identities that women and folks across the gender spectrum hold and taking those into account, and, you know, really working to support other folks as much as you can, and also being willing to, you know, speak up when it's essential to speak up, but also listen and be quiet when it's appropriate to listen and be quiet. But it's a journey. And I think the goal is, of course, that equality, that gender equality that we are still unfortunately quite far from, that I try to work in my everyday life towards. So yeah, that's a long-winded answer, but it is a tricky question.
I like that answer because you're hitting on something that we don't hear very often, and that it's an ongoing process. It's not one day you read a book, suddenly you're the perfect feminist. It is messy, and we're going to make mistakes, and we're going to learn more, and we're going to regret some of the things that we've said or done. And that's okay. Like, feminism has to encompass all the messy parts too.
Absolutely. And that's true across fields. Like, my parents are scientists. My dad's a neuroscientist. My mom is a cancer cell biologist. And, you know, to be able to call yourself a neuroscientist in the year 2020 is a very different thing than, you know, calling yourself a neuroscientist in 1920, you know? And it's not just political movements that are really messy and constantly evolving. It's all kinds of fields, you know, like scientific discovery is an incredibly messy process too. And so, yeah, I mean, anything worth studying and aligning yourself with is going to be complicated and hopefully evolving all the time as we, you know, as culture evolves, as language evolves. And, you know, as long as we're like learning more and becoming more advanced and becoming more knowledgeable, then yeah, the movement or the field has to move forward. It has to change.
And one way we're doing that is being more intentional, concise, respectful with our language. And that's where Word Slut comes in. So tell our audience a little bit about your book, Word Slut.
Yeah. So Word Slut is what they call a brash, enlightening, and wildly entertaining look at gendered language and the way it shapes us, written with humor and playfulness. And it includes chapters such as slutty skank hoes and nasty dykes, a comprehensive list of gendered insults I hate, but also kind of love, ? How to embarrass the shit out of people who try to correct your grammar, fuck it, an ode to cursing while female. There's a chapter on grammatical gender. There's a chapter about women's voices in public and how we perceive, you know, the voices of female authority figures. There's a chapter on genitalia naming slang throughout history and what it says about our narratives of sex and desire. So it really is this like quick and dirty crash course in this, you know, pretty scholarly, like academic, kind of dry topic of feminist sociolinguistics, but filtered through my voice. And made, you know, accessible and funny.
It is so accessible, so funny. I was a communication and gender studies major, and that's what I studied all through my master's and PhD coursework as well. And so I remember my very first women's studies class, though, we had like a week on sociolinguistics, and I was just blown away. And there's so much that you tackled in such an approachable book that I'm going to be recommending this to everybody. But before we get into some of the things that I honestly have like a full page list of questions, so we'll see what we get to. But the first one, because I'm such a geek about this, but the first one is, can you define linguistics for us so we're all on the same page?
Yeah. No, that's a great question because I didn't even know what linguistics was before I started studying it in college. That's what my degree is in. My whole life had been fascinated by what I found out was this thing called linguistics. But I was not familiar with that word. So linguistics is the science of language, and it's different from, you know, elocution or something like prescriptive grammar. It's different from being a speech pathologist or a translator. A lot of people say like, oh, you're a linguist, so do you speak a lot of languages? And while it's often the case that linguists will acquire new languages because we're just obsessed with that sort of thing, really a linguist is someone who studies some aspect of the science of language. And there are so many different subfields. So there's phonetics, there's phonology, there's semantics, there's syntax. I thought it was so funny when I took my semantics class that there's that idiom in English, like, oh, that's just semantics, which people say to like dismiss an argument or prevent it from moving forward. But there is an entire field of study that people dedicate their whole lives to called semantics, which is the study of meaning. It's kind of like language philosophy. But sociolinguistics is where the studies of linguistics and sociology intersect. So sociolinguistics is its own incredibly wide encompassing field, but it's all about, you know, the relationship between language and human experience and how language affects how we move through the world and vice versa. And so when I took my first gender and language class in college, and I'm such a linguistics nerd, like phonetics and phonology, that is my jam. Like my phonetics class was everything. I just loved learning about. So phonetics is like speech production and the study of sounds, basically. And I just like loved learning about the many sounds that exist throughout the world's languages. And I remember there was this one midterm exam in my phonetics class where we had to learn the International Phonetic Alphabet, which is an alphabet of symbols, not letters, that translate to phonetic sounds that anybody all over the world can use. And we had to learn like this huge inventory of phonetic symbols to represent different sounds from the world's languages, including like the German R or click sounds from the Khoisan languages of West Africa. And I remember for our midterm exam, we'd be given these like strings of random phonetic, like made up words written in IPA. And we would have to like pronounce them. So a word might be like, haha. Like I just thought that was like so fun. That was a complete tangent, but the language and gender stuff though was the most sort of like applicable and relevant to my life. And yeah, I was just mind blown to learn about, you know, just some of the really subtle but deeply embedded ways that gender and, you know, male default thinking show up in language, the language that we use every day, from, you know, the insults and curse words that we use to, you know, grammatical elements in English and other languages, grammatical gender, you know, when nouns have a masculine or feminine classification is obviously not something we have in English, but grammatical gender shows up in other ways in our language. One of the top of mind examples that's relevant to COVID and quarantine was the piece of news that was announced a few days ago that the grammar authorities in France have determined that COVID-19 is formally and officially a feminine noun. And that didn't surprise me because, you know, it's so often the case in other languages, but also in English, that sort of like dangerous, unpredictable, wild things are referred to with the pronoun she, like cars and natural disasters and oceans and countries. And I was like, oh, of course, the, you know, stuffy grammarians in France are like, COVID-19, it will be a woman. So yeah, those are just some of the ways. But yeah, all of that stuff blew my mind. And I'm so thrilled and shocked that I got to write a book about it, because it's the stuff that I would think about and talk about with my friends all the time. But, you know, it's so niche, like feminist sociolinguistics. Who knew that anyone would let me write a book about it?
And who knew that it would get such big praise and such big
publication and publisher. And it just speaks to how this is why I dropped out of academia, is one of many reasons, is that it's so insular and we're taught to write as academics in a very academic way. And it doesn't permeate to the rest of the culture. And books like this, as popular academic writing, is what actually creates change. I'm so grateful that you're chatting with us, that you're doing this work. And also, I have to know more about your next book, which is The Language of Cults, which I'm a listeners know I am obsessed with cults.
Same.
And so I'm looking forward to that. Okay, but I want to go back to some ways that gender stereotypes show up in language, especially in the English language. I mean, we could talk about gendered grammar, but in the English language, what are some of those other ways that you see are maybe insidious? Maybe we don't realize that they're there and we're using, you know, sexist language and we don't even know it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are so many examples. What to start with? I mean, the first thing, and the way that I start the book, is talking about gendered insults, because they're these four letter words. They're kind of controversial. We love using them. You know, you mentioned I'm a cursor. I love my curse words, but it is an empirical fact that there just exist more gender-based insults describing women or referencing femininity than there are for men or referencing masculinity. So there was this one linguist who conducted a study in the 90s where she collected these inventories of gendered insults, or really gendered slang in general, for men and women. And it was so apparent that there are just so many more insults about femininity, from, you know, bitch, slut, hoe, hussy, even old timey ones. And then, you know, the insults for men are so much fewer. So much fewer. That's a funny way to phrase that. an oxymoron, but it works. And you know, what's really interesting is that so many of the current insults that we have referencing femininity didn't start out as insults at all. They underwent a form of semantic change called pejoration, where a word starts out having a neutral or positive meaning and devolves over time to mean something negative. And really, you know, every word the English language has ever offered to describe a woman has at some point during its lifespan been colored some shade of obscene. So, you know, bitch, linguists theorize, has its origins in this Sanskrit word, which meant genitalia, anyone's genitalia. The word cunt, the most, you know, ostensibly offensive word in the English language, also did not start as an insult. The root of the word is really, really old. People think that it's related to this word sound that's similar to the one that we find in queen and cow, this word sound that just like referenced femininity in general with no negative connotations whatsoever, but it devolved over time. And really, like, a theme that we find is so many terms for women that, again, start out as totally neutral, maybe even positive, maybe having nothing to do with femininity at all, even devolve into like a sexual slur. And that really says something about how we perceive women in our culture. And there are so many words for men that could have pejorated like they have for women, but they didn't. And we can look at minimal pairs like the words buddy and sissy. So those back in the day used to just mean brother and sister. They were, you know, totally neutral, but buddy ameliorated over time. That's the opposite of pejoration, is amelioration, when a word that means something neutral or negative evolves to mean something positive. Buddy ameliorated over time to mean like a friendly pal, while sissy went the other way and devolved to mean, you know, this sort of like weak, contemptibly feminine man, who, God forbid, reminds you of a woman. And there are so many other examples of that, like master and madam. You know, those used to mean male and female head of household. Master evolved to mean, you know, a connoisseur, a specialist of some subject, while madam meant, you know, devolved to mean the head of a brothel. So that's just something we see time and time again, and that's only one example. There are countless others that, you know, aren't so vulgar, if you will. Like, you know, there's the pervasive assumption that so many ostensibly gender neutral professions, from, you know, doctor to professor to actor even, are male until proven otherwise. And we can see that in words like salesman and chairman and things like that. But also when we say things like female scientist, woman doctor, it really reflects that assumption that these esteemed professions are tacitly coded male. There are like too many examples to name, but those are just a few.
So what are some of the things that we can do as feminists to ensure that we're using our language appropriately to smash the patriarchy appropriately?
Yeah, sure. So like, I would say that there are more things that we don't have to do to modify our language than things that we do have to do. So there's this one chapter in my book called Women Didn't Ruin the English Language, They Like Invented It, which provides like all this empirical evidence defending certain characteristics often noticed and reviled in women's speech, like saying like every other word or using upspeak where you end a declarative sentence in the upward intonation of a question like this, or a vocal fry where you speak with your vocal folds in a very relaxed position, using hedges such as, you know, like, you know, actually over and over again, asking tag questions like, I think it's supposed to rain tomorrow, right? Or, you know, things like that that are so criticized in women's speech and, you know, thought to be signs of insecurity and uncertainty and ditziness. But linguists have, you know, conducted these amazing studies that aren't talked about enough, really disproving all of those myths and showing that, you know, these characteristics are really signs of linguistic savvy and that young women tend to be are linguistic innovators. Linguists have found that time and time again to be true, that, you know, young people tend to be ahead of old people when it comes to language change, and women tend to be about half a generation ahead of men. And one of the theories for that is that women tend to use language as a form of social power in a culture that doesn't give them a ton of other ways to do that. And so the book provides women, but also, you know, folks who hold marginalized identities whose speech is reviled in general, like, you know, folks who speak a certain dialect who are constantly criticized for talking in a way that's grammatically incorrect, like speakers of African American vernacular English, or, you know, folks who use the quote unquote gay voice. Like, these are people who are told by the spin doctors and their bosses and, you know, commentators and journalists that they need to change the way that they speak in order to sound more like old straight white men, because that's the standard. But really, there's all this fascinating evidence proving that that's not true. And one of my favorites is the study on the word like, proving that there are these six completely distinct forms of the word like that have developed over time, and they're all homonyms, just like the noun watch, meaning the timepiece on your wrist, and the verb watch, meaning what you do with your eyes when you turn on the TV, are homonyms, and they all have a really specific purpose, and using one or all of them in the same sentence isn't inherently bad. We just think of it that way because of our own stereotypes about young women. And meanwhile, like, old dudes use the word like all the time because it has been popularized and entered the everyday lexicon. It's just that, you know, we don't like when women invent language because that's not how the power structure is supposed to go. So there's way more that we don't have to do to change our language. And one thing that I really want to do with the book is just empower people with these like bulletproof hard facts, so that if they're voices are criticized in public, whether, you know, someone is, whether they're, you know, their mom is telling them that they say like too much, or someone on Twitter is dragging them for using, you know, grammar incorrectly, they'll just have like a linguistic weapon at the ready to like clap back and feel so empowered. Because something that a lot of people tell me is that, you know, the word slut put a name and statistics and figures to frustrations that they've always had but could never really back up. And so now, like, with the facts in the book, people are able to engage in a dialogue defending some of these features in a way that they weren't able to before. But in terms of, you know, what we can do to change our language to linguistically smash the patriarchy and make sure that we're, you know, pushing our language and our culture in the right direction is, you know, really just to be gentle with ourselves, first of all, because language change is difficult and it's messy, just like feminism itself, and it changes slowly and over time. But I think just, you know, carefully considering some of those, you know, low-key sexist words and grammatical constructions and deciding whether or not we want to use them. So for example, like after I learned about the history of gendered insults for men and women, like bitch and slut for women and, you know, sissy and pussy for men, after I learned like the real weight that these words carry and the real impact that they can have, I stopped using them in a negative light. I still use slut, obviously. My book is called Word Slut. I still use bitch, but I love these words and I don't want anyone to tell me that I can't use them, but I find myself only using them in positive contexts, you know, word slut, bad bitch, etc. And never using them to chastise someone because I think it's so strange that in our language, when someone does something that we don't like, our go-to move is to insult their gender. You know, you're a bitch. It's like, what? Like this thing that I just did has nothing to do with me being a woman. And so I tend to, when I want to insult someone, and I do that all the time, I try to be more specific and accurate and scathing and gender neutral with my language instead of just being like, oh, whatever, like you're such a dick. You know, why call someone a dick if you can call them a conniving, manipulative asshole? Everybody's got an asshole. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's my little piece about reclamation. And what linguists have found time and time again is that words so often become reclaimed because young speakers grow up in a culture where those words are now only being used in a positive context. And that's what we've seen with a word like queer, that used to be, you know, a really abusive homophobic slur that has, you know, largely been reclaimed by the LGBTQ+ community and academia. And so now, you know, there are people who disagree, of course, because the path to reclamation is not a linear one. But that's a pretty victorious example of a reclaimed slur. So I try not to use some of those really damaging insults that are gendered, and instead insult people in a more gender neutral and really biting way if I can.
You have some great examples in the book too of just like things that you can say instead of dick or bitch. They're fantastic.
Yeah. And then I also, you know, try to default to gender neutral language. You know, I talked about male default thinking. You know, a little thing that I'm asked about all the time is the phrase you guys, because people think that, you know, at this point that phrase has become gender neutral. And I do get why people love you guys ever since that term cropped up only around the 80s to fill the lexical gap that exists in English where we don't have a second person plural pronoun. It's become this like cozy, casual phrase that's extremely useful and it feels good and it rolls right off the tongue. But when you guys first, you know, emerged in the 80s, gender and language scholars were shocked because we were like post-second wave feminist movement when all these strides had been made toward more inclusive language. And then out of nowhere, this like very gendered term had popped up. And, you know, the fact that people think it is gender neutral just really reflects that default male thinking that is so pervasive in our culture. You know, you would never call a group of both men and women you gals. It just wouldn't happen because, you know, there's this idea that women can be elevated to the status of men, but men do not want to be lowered to the status of women, which is, you know, there's a fashion equivalent. Like it's why you see women walking around in pants, but you never see men, frequently see men walking around in skirts. And there are, you know, linguistic analogs of that. So I don't say you guys anymore. And I people think, you know, it's so hard to beat that out of your system, but really it's not. And there are so many alternatives. I say y'all, my mom is from New Orleans, so I grew up hearing that. I say y'all, you all, you, yins, yous. There are so many that work. And yeah, I do my best to default to gender neutral language whenever I can, just so that I'm not assuming anyone's gender, but also so that I'm not, you know, perpetuating those default male standards.
Yeah, when I waited tables many years ago, our manager slash owner of the restaurant had one of those like memos that was posted on the back fridge or whatever that said, please try to refrain from saying you guys, because some people do find that offensive. And here's a list of other things you can say. And I respected her so much because I grew up in Indiana where saying you folks and the word folks is so common that that's always what I've used. You know, what can I get you folks today? What are you folks doing today? You know, and it sounds very folksy and like, I just leaned into my Hoosier roots, but I learned so much about language waiting tables and what people think about other people's language waiting tables. I think it's so interesting. I think I learned more about my language use and others' responses to my language use there than I ever did listening or creating podcasts or in school. It's just how we wield these linguistic devices in public is so interesting and so ever-changing too.
Yeah, you were conducting your own little field study. But yeah, the restaurant would be much more interesting because that's a more unfiltered population. So you're really getting a sense of how everyday folks use language. I think folks is making a comeback because here in LA, people are using folks right and left, you know, in an effort to be more gender neutral. And so whenever I hear it, I feel all warm and fuzzy. I think folks is just as charming as guys. It just doesn't have that like laid back cool factor that guys
It's like have. Old fashioned.
It's old fashioned.
It's old fashioned and Midwestern.
right, totally. But I think, you know, some of these like slightly more contemporary terms like guys and dude, they have this cool factor that's I think, you know, pretty intrinsically linked with masculinity. You know, we see men as more, just like more cool and more casual. Like I call my best friends dude. I don't call them girl, you know? Mm-hmm. Actually, my like main paper that I wrote in my gender and language class was about the word dude. This is the fun of being a linguistics major, is that you can like focus on stuff like that and it counts toward your degree. But yeah, I like conducted this study about men's and women's usages of the word dude on the West Coast versus the East Coast, and what that said about like the prestige that they assigned to the word dude and, you know, inherently to masculinity. And I find that, you know, in California, casualness is valued more than it is on the East Coast. And so you hear dude thrown around like right and left. And that all also has to do with dude's origins, or not origins, but like its popularization as a slang term from like surfer movies and stuff. But yeah, it does seem that because Californians use dude so much that there's like a valuing of casual laid back masculinity that comes along with it. So anyways, all this stuff is just like, I could nerd out forever.
I was gonna say, I wanna crawl up into your brain and just like listen to you. One of the things that really surprised me to read is, I mean, I know a lot of this, I learned a lot of this in school, but one of the pieces of your book that really took me aback and made me rethink the way that I speak is your, I don't think it's a whole chapter, but there's a section on hedging. And so as a communication studies major, we were taught in order to be a concise communicator that hedging is something that you might want to avoid. And it was something that I taught public speaking for many years. And it was something that I would bring up and say, you know, women and women identified folks are socialized to use hedging quite a bit more than men or masculine folks. And here's why you probably shouldn't use it, but you have changed my mind on the judgment of hedging. So can you share a little bit about what hedging is and why it's not as bad as we were all taught to do and say?
Yeah. That's so funny. I mean, I think like, first I want to say that, I wish I had conducted these hedging studies by myself. They were not conducted by me. I'm just, you know, spreading the gospel and sharing it and, you know, putting my spin on it. But, and the other thing that I'll say is that, you know, in certain contexts, preciseness is what you're going for and concision is what you're going for. I'm not gonna, you know, hedge when I'm writing a book, as I would hedge in casual conversation. I probably wouldn't hedge as much giving a presentation, in a workplace atmosphere or giving a speech, you know? But yeah, like the myths that we tend to believe about like why women hedge, are dispelled in the book, thanks to the work of some linguists. And yeah, I can definitely talk about that. So, basically hedges are also known as filler words. And there are these, you know, little phrases like just, and, you know, actually, I feel like, and, you know, people historically have confused these, you know, softening hedges, if you will, for like signs of insecurity and uncertainty and like not knowing the next thing that you're going to say. And there was this early language and gender scholar named Robin Lakoff, who wrote one of the like foremost earliest books called Language and Woman's Place. She was really like the, you know, the godmother of this field of study. And she was groundbreaking because she was one of the first people to take a serious empirical look at this, but she got a lot of things wrong. And one of the things that she got wrong, which is something that a lot of people get wrong to this day, is that, you know, just as women are taught to be like excessively humble and insecure about their appearance, you know, there's that like Amy Schumer sketch where, you know, everybody's exchanging compliments and one woman's like, I love your purse. And she's just like, no, I look like a haggard old, I don't know, like Amy Schumer is funny and I'm not. So yeah, like we're not taught to like own our confidence, whether it's, you know, fashion or language. And because we've been, you know, taught that it's socially acceptable and more feminine to be unsure or uncertain of what we're saying, we've, you know, been conditioned to use these like overly deferential hedges, like just, you know, which we pepper throughout our sentences, in order to, you know, like soften the conviction of them. But really what linguists have found is that hedging serves a much more complicated purpose. Not all hedges do the same thing, first of all, and I could talk forever just about that. You could write a whole book just on the specific you know, practical usages of each individual hedge. But basically, overall, to generalize, hedges are used to create empathy and solidarity and foster communication and invite other people into the conversation. And women more often than not need hedges because we delve into sensitive topics in our conversations more often than men. And so we need justs and you knows and I feel likes to create that trust and empathy, and to really, you know, consider the face needs of everyone in the conversation. And there was a study that I reference in the book where this linguist observed a conversation happening between a bunch of female friends, and they were talking about this like Jack the Ripper murder case in Yorkshire in the UK from the 80s. And one of the women was talking about how like back in the day, during that case, when the murderer was still on the loose, people were supposed to like call the police if they thought that like someone in their family might be Jack the Ripper. And she was like telling the story about how she thought it might have been her husband. And she has, I actually have the sentence pulled up. She says, "Oh God, yes. Well, I mean, we were living in Yorkshire at the time. And I sort of thought, well, could it be John? Those wells, I means, sort ofs, like those are all hedges and there are so many of them, but she's not putting them in there because she's not sure of what she's saying. She knows exactly what she wants to say, but if she says it without all of those hedges, let me read that version. That would be, yes, we were living in Yorkshire at the time. I thought, could it be John? Like, no one talks like that. If she talked like that, she would sound like an unfeeling, brusque robot. People would be like, what the fuck? You thought it was your husband and you're just like stating it like that? That's crazy. But yeah, like is also a hedge. And studies have found that speech lacking in likes and you knows is often seen as robotic and unfriendly. And so, yeah, they serve a purpose. And they're not just because women have been conditioned to speak like with uncertainty and insecurity. They're like pretty necessary in a lot of contexts.
Yeah, I loved that point. And like I said, think of filler words and hedging in a completely different light as really a modicum of face work, the kind of work that you do with another person in dialogue to manage credibility and manage reputation and create and collaborate, this co-collaboration of meaning that you do when you're in dialogue with someone.
Exactly, exactly. And like the point of language is not always to communicate something in the most precise way. Like sometimes it is, but not always. I mean, I'm just thinking of another example. Like what if you were to say to someone, what if you were to suggest to someone that they should see a therapist? You could say, I mean, I feel like, you know, maybe you should try like seeing a therapist. Or you could say, you should see a therapist. Like, which one is going to be received better? When you're talking about something so sensitive and personal, and women so often do, like, you need the hedges. You just do.
Yes, yes. Oh, there is so much that we could continue to talk about. We are running low on time, although, I mean, like, definitely, this should definitely be a conversation that we should all continue to have. And just think about your language. It's so fascinating. And the way that we use language is so fascinating. I've got a few quick questions. Do you have a favorite linguistic fact? Something that just blows your mind?
Oh my God, this is not a linguistic fact. This is like a stupid Snapple fact. This is like not even this isn't even cool, but the word facetiously is the only word in the English language that has every single vowel in alphabetical order.
I love that. That was what I was hoping for. Okay, there are two words that you touch on in the book that I want you to just give a quick and dirty history and whether or not we should use it. The first one is hysterical.
The word hysteria is extremely old, like thousands of years old. It's derived from the ancient Greek word for womb. And it evolved to describe a female mental disorder in the 19th century, categorized by like female emotional instability without cause. It's theorized that a treatment for hysteria back then was this thing called hysterical paroxysm, where a male doctor would like masturbate a female patient to orgasm, and that was supposed to cure her hysteria. So that's insane. That's truly hysterical. This definition has remained that like hysteria is this distinctly female form of craziness. I had a terrible toxic ex-boyfriend who used to call me hysterical all the time, and it fucking triggers me. I do not use the word hysterical to describe women because it derives from this like completely unfounded female mental disorder. It's just like fucked up. I don't use it.
What about when you call somebody who is funny hysterical?
Oh, in that context, well, even so, like I find myself not going for it. I would rather say hilarious. I'll say that from time to time. Context, I always want to stress, context in language is so deeply important. And we as listeners and conversationalists are really exquisitely good at picking up on context and intention when we talk. And so if, you know, a man is telling me while I'm expressing myself, emotional way that I'm hysterical, that's obviously going to hit a little different than if someone tells a joke and I'm like, ha ha, ha, you're hysterical. Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm.
All right. The other word that you address in a footnote, and I was so, so grateful for this footnote, is you called, I think, a study seminal. And then your footnote was something like, can we just pause for a second to address how phallic that term is?
Oh my God. Thank you for reading the footnotes. The footnotes of everything. People who read the footnotes are in like a special club. I take such pride in my footnotes. My next book is gonna have like fun footnotes. I haven't like deeply looked into the word seminal, to be honest, but yeah, it is gross.
Yeah, I mean, it refers to semen. And so I will offer, it's something that I've tried not to use in my vocabulary because I feel like that is one of those like carries like a weirdly gendered history. And so I'm going to offer an alternative to seminal, and that is germane. That is a non-gendered option for that.
Yeah, love that.
Anyways, so I just thought that was so funny because that's
not like I even say, I like never say seminal. Like, when does anyone ever need to say seminal? Ew.
I mean, if we really wanted to, we could say ovular instead.
Oh, yes. Let's do
because
that.
Because life does begin with eggs. So let's do that.
It okay. really does.
Finally, when can we expect the FX show?
Oh, God. Well, it's in development, you know? That Hollywood term meaning like it might happen. but it's a really, okay, so obviously like this book doesn't lend itself to a narrative story perfectly or anything, but I did create the show about this young language genius who like knows everything under the sun about language. She's like a super polyglot. She's a computational linguist and like a genius programmer. She has like a freakish knowledge of etymologies and slang and dialects, and she's just like brilliant, but she's also a complete mess, knows nothing of herself, is in like a terrible relationship, doesn't have a real job. She's just like, you know, one of those geniuses who like can't get their life together. But she gets this like big career break at the beginning of the show. And she goes on these adventures where she's using her linguistic superpower to like take down powerful people. And so I'm currently writing the pilot. It's really fun. It's so glamorous just to think that a show might get made based on my like linguistics obsession. And I'm working with Pamela Adlon, if you know who that is. She's an amazing, amazing actor, television creator. She has a show on FX called Better Things, which she created and wrote and directs and stars in. And she's awesome. And so it's just like, you know, it feels cool to be able to, you know, develop this muscle, like writing for television. It's really fun. I hope it gets made. I'm like, thank you.
I want to watch this so hard. I just want to binge the shit out of this show. Like,
It's so cool. It's like kind of like a funny, like a not fun. I mean, it's a dark show, but it's kind of like a darkly funny Girl with the Dragon Tattoo vibes.
Perfect. Let's hear it. Let's do it. Let me know if you need any help. all right. My last two questions. If we want to follow you online, what's the best place to do that?
You can follow me on Instagram. I don't tweet. That's not very authorly of me not to tweet, but I post on Instagram at Amanda_Montel. And there I post a lot of like mini videos. Lately, I've been posting these quote unquote Amanda University videos where I post like 3-minute lessons about language. And if you are interested in that stuff, you can see me there.
Amazing. And my final question, I'm going to do this as a 2-part question because I can't get enough of your brain. I always ask somebody for a book recommendation. So if you have a book to recommend that's not your own, what would you recommend? And a second book that you would recommend to readers who loved this book and want more of this kind of popular academic feminism. So those are, that could be the same book, but it could be 2.
Yeah. Okay. Well, a book that I'm reading right now, I just started it, is the memoir Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls by T. Kira Madden.
Mm-hmm.
I just started it, but it's really cool. It's like beautiful literary writing. It's a memoir, but the structure is really interesting. It's like kind of essay-esque. And her voice is just unique. And I really like her too. I like follow her on Instagram.
She's cool as hell.
Very cool. So I haven't finished it, but that one is like sitting next to me and top of mind. And then what else? For people who are interested in my book and that topic. Honestly, there are no other books about language and gender.
Well, what about just feminist theory that's easily accessible that could be in this similar vein, not necessarily about language?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Lindy West's The Witches Are Coming.
So good.
Yeah, so good. So good. I like, LA is so funny. I just found out yesterday, like, my neighbor, my next door neighbor, who I'd never met IRL before, but like we have each other's numbers, long story. She invited me over for a doggy play date. And I was like, yeah, sure. And I went over there and we started talking. And she's the creator and showrunner of Shrill.
That's amazing.
Isn't that cool?
That is cool.
Like, oh, nice to meet you. I love that show. I love Lindy West.
Oh my gosh. Our June book of the month is Samantha Irby's new book. And Samantha is one of the writers on Shrill too.
Yeah. Well, she
and
writes
we read about Shrill recently. So
yeah, she like has an essay about Shrill in the book.
I haven't read it yet. It's on its way at the moment we're recording.
Yeah, I mean, she's like amazing. So yeah, I would say, you know, Lindy West is so fucking funny. Like I aspire to be that funny, and has, you know, really astute points about feminism, like low key, super sophisticated feminist theory. But, you know, she's so funny that you almost like don't even notice that it hit you. Like, wow, that was so smart, but it was fucking hilarious. So
she has a chapter in The Witches Are Coming about Adam Sandler movies, and it struck so close to home that I read it and I had to put it down and just like process a feminist critique of Adam Sandler movies circa, you know, 1998 to 2002. And I was like, this is my like coming of age story. I didn't even know it.
I believe that she's working on a new book right now that's all like TV and movie reviews.
Oh my God. I can't wait.
And then if people are interested in like the nerdy language part of it, there are a few language books out that I like. There's one that I really like called Word by Word by Corey Stamper. And she was a former lexicographer at Merriam-Webster's. And it's like part memoir, part like ode to the English language. She's like even nerdier than I am. She majored in medieval studies she basically majored in old English, or middle English or something, which is like so nerdy. But yeah, Corey Stamper's Word by Word is really, really fun.
Amazing. I'll put those all in the show notes. I'll put your book in the show notes. Congratulations on the paperback coming out. And this has been an absolute joy to read and to talk to you and to just really geek out. Like, it's unusual that we get to geek out this hard on this podcast.
I know.
Thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you. Honestly, this is like my favorite thing. So,
all right. We'll talk soon, Amanda.
Awesome.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.